This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go? Welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go? This was a live interview, and I don't normally do introductions like this for live interviews, but I think I need to explain a little bit about what you're going to hear. This interview was done with Peter Robbins on the whole time, and we brought in Ryan Sprague for a little bit to talk about the UFO conference. The problem was that Skype was not cooperating at all. So, in the live broadcast, there's a little bit of us stalling while we try to get Ryan connected. For some reason, Skype refused to call him into the group. And then I went to a song and came back and had Ryan and wasn't able to connect Peter. So, instead of just leaving that all in there, I cut it all out. You'll hear the cut markers with little tone plays. That's what's been cut out. Nothing of any real consequence. Just making it a more streamlined listening experience. There was no way to make the cuts seem natural, so that's why you hear the little intonation that you're going to hear. And, well, that's about it. Enjoy the conversation. You with us, Peter?
I am indeed.
It's weird not having you here in studio.
Yeah, this is weird for us. as you know, yours is the only show in this period of time that I do live.
The Opinions Express.
You're in beautiful downtown Ithaca, and I'm in beautiful Enfield, not 7 miles away, but... tonight, I'm a little under the weather, and the weather's under the weather, too. So
it's like an endless assault of cold and snow this February.
It is. The ice age someday will recede back to Canada, and legend has it that spring will return. I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah, yeah. And I really hope it doesn't all melt in one day.
Oh, God. That'd be a terrible tease, it's true.
But next time you should be in studio. We tried to move this forward because of the weather, and it just didn't improve.
No, it didn't.
It's pretty amazing, really.
It is. You know, I try to keep in mind our brothers and sisters in New England, especially friends that I have in Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Maine in great part, who are under 7-8 feet. And, you know, it's just madness. It's just madness. And for those that feel that climate change is a myth, come on up here to visit us in the great Northeast.
Well, you got to admit, though, it has been this bad before, just not in a long time.
Well, you've lived up here a lot longer than I have, but certainly in the 10 years that I've been here, we've never had this much snow, and I don't think temperatures that have dropped down this low, and you know, to continue on for a little bit on a non-UFO related note, my dad, who's been up here for about 20 years, is a meticulous record keeper, and he told me the other day that I think 4 years ago the driveway of the house had been plowed twice. 3 years ago, like six times. Last year, 10 times for the whole winter. This year, 17, 18 times already. we're snowed in. It's just the way it is.
And how many times of those were in February? Most of them?
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't really that bad until it hit February, and then suddenly we got snow, and then more snow, and then more snow, and then lots of wind, and cold, and more snow, and it's like, come on, give us a break.
It ain't doing that, unfortunately.
Well, maybe by June. Anyway, Peter, what have you been up to since the last time you've been on?
Well, mostly writing. This has been a particularly quiet couple of months for me is sometimes the year starts out. I have not been down in Manhattan since just after New Year's, and usually I'm there once a month or so, at least once a month. But it's allowed me to persevere on a manuscript for a new book, go after more speaking jobs for the latter part of the year, work on some articles, editing a friend's book, writing a foreword to another friend's book, researching several projects, and doing an awful lot of radio, I must say.
Oh, all right.
Both here and in the UK.
Can you tell us a little about the new book? Or are you keeping that under wraps?
I'll tell you very little about it. It's basically a double sort of strategy where I'll be taking a number of what I feel are some of the best and most important pieces of research that I've done over the years and adapting them for various size chapters, so to say, but interspersing them with more personal accounts, stories from the field, memories of working certain cases, key individuals I've gotten to work with, and go back and forth in a roughly chronological order so that I'll be kind of working small picture, large picture, my experience and development in this work contrasted with, what I think again are some of the best research that I've done, and continue on in that spirit. So, yeah.
All right. Well, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah. I will keep you posted.
I hope so. And your last book, Deception, is available on WhereDidTheRoadGo.com for free. It's one of two books that's up for free, that one and The Darwin Conspiracy by Roy Davies is also there if people want to download it completely free.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, that book's impossible to find, so he just wanted it out there so people could read it. And kind of like yours, really.
Yeah.
So.
Bravo.
And you can also find your book. I have it up as a zip file so people can get all the chapters as one. It's a pretty big file, but it can also be found where?
All you need to do is go to the website of Phenomena Magazine. They're a wonderful monthly that comes out of Manchester, UK. Again, that's Phenomena Magazine. And once you are on their page, look for the box that says Special Reports. Click on that, and it will take you to kind of a cyber bookshelf, which has seven book icons on it, and just download all seven in order onto your PC, and the book is yours.
All right. So those are your two options. You can get it, in individual chapters or as a zip off WhereDidTheRoadGo.com.
That's great.
So one of the things I wanted to bring up that I found kind of interesting is a couple of news reports that have come out recently. And the first one is that, they announced in big headlines that the Project Blue Book files have finally been released, but they've always been released. Why do you think the big deal all of a sudden, is being made? Is it just that the media companies don't have a clue, or are they playing some kind of game?
Well, I think part of it is that there may well, and I haven't looked at all the material, God knows, there may well have been additional paperwork which was gotten by the Black Vault, terrific, terrific website, which has more formally classified documents on it for anybody to access than any other website in the world, as far as I know.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it. I think that major media, corporate media, is always looking for another news story that has those three letters UFO in it, even if they can't make fun of it. And this is one that they really can't, although, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, when news readers have put this on at the piece at the end of, a regular newscast, it's usually done with a slight smile on the face. Business as usual, of course.
Right, right. Maybe some X-Files music. And the other one I'm looking at is, this is from back in the beginning of January. CIA reveals the truth about UFOs. And, of course, the article I'm looking at immediately has a picture of Fox and Mulder from the X-Files. And it talks about how some of the UFO reports in the 50s and 60s were actually secret craft, like the U2 program and stuff. But that, again, really isn't new information. I think most UFO researchers realize some of these things are top secret craft.
Yes.
And the way the news report lays it out, it's as if they've explained the UFO phenomena with this until they get to the bottom and say, it's just a few cases, select cases, like when pilots were at a certain height and certain time of the day and the U2 bombers were up really high. They had a kind of a fiery reflection from the sun and were mistaken for UFOs. But if people just scan the headlines, well, there's the UFO, you know, thing all explained. It's the CIA.
Yeah, the fact is that I think you answered your own question. It's another way of spinning our wheels, of putting forth very old news as new news, almost to make people say, so why did you even bother to make that report? Maybe there's something here that I'm missing, or to have stick in their minds that some anomalous looking things that we see in the sky are ours. And I think most of the most savvy people in the research community are more than willing to admit immediately that most, if not the great majority, of that stuff is in fact ours, but
sure,
would not have been, you know, in the 40s and 50s most likely.
Right, right, or before that.
Yes.
And that's the whole reason Jacques Vallée wrote his most recent book, is it's all the pre-UFO era UFOs, because we didn't have stuff up there at the time.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there. I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, this is the nature of the beast, it seems to me. Just beat us down, inundate us, you know, give these teasing little stories that go absolutely nowhere. And if it works for you, what I'd like to do right now, because we're about at a quarter after, let's try to give our friend Ryan Sprague a call.
Yeah, let's see if we can bring him in.
I have him on Skype. Great. Because what's going on right now, for listeners that are not aware, probably the largest of our national UFO conferences is going on right now as we speak. That's the International UFO Congress, which takes place in Scottsdale or Phoenix, I forget the designation, every February for the past number of years. And I'm sure draws close to 1,000 people. Ryan is there right now. He's an independent investigative writer. We share a great other thing in common. He's a playwright, an actor, and has been combining those two passions of his. But he's been out there digging up story material, listening to the talks, and I'm also curious to find out what he thought of the documentary that I executive produced that was screened, I believe, last night. So see if you can get him on.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be working. I'm hitting it, and it wants me to add a phone number rather than bringing him in like it should. So I'm not sure what's going on.
Classic.
Oh, thanks, Skype. All right. So I did have another question for you. And now I forgot what it was because I was playing with Skype. We were talking about there was actually someone I was just talking to, just a friend who had a father in the military. And he had mentioned that when he was a kid, his dad was working all this top secret stuff and would occasionally tell him about it, even though he wasn't supposed to. And he thought, you know, his dad was telling him tall tales of all this technology and stuff. And then 20 years later, he sees this stuff actually being rolled out and realized that his dad was telling him the truth. And who knows what they have now,
yeah,
you know, that they're just not going to tell us. And they may never tell us.
Well, yes, they may never. It seems to be the nature of the beast. It's really important to remember that, you know, your story right there, I've heard variations of it for so many years from different people that I've met with credible, you know, backing to their accounts, and often involving a parent who had worked in some classified area of the military. For me, one of the best examples is an aircraft that has been retired for some years. One of the most legendary spy planes of all time, the one that replaced the famous U-2 called the SR-71,
right,
and affectionately nicknamed the Blackbird. This plane was designed in the Eisenhower era by Kelly Johnson, arguably the greatest military aircraft designer of all time. It came out of the Lockheed Skunk Works in California. It was tested in Nevada, and it was deployed no later than about 61 in the early years of the Kennedy administration. So first of all, let's remember we're talking about technology here that's well over half a century old. And the SR could climb at 10,000 feet a minute, could go Mach 3, could cruise at over 100,000 feet, possibly 120,000 feet. It had two pilots, CIA-trained, NASA-trained, CIA-controlled, no weapons unless they carried sidearms, skin of titanium, again, three times the speed of sound, and could proverbially, with its great Hasselblad cameras, photograph a license plate on the ground in Russia at 60,000 feet. This is technology that is more than half a century old. And this is before the great digital revolution. This is analog technology. Where we are right now, where we are right now, forget about them, I think it is almost impossible to imagine, even if you have a technological background.
Yeah.
And that is a really important thing to keep in touch with in seeing the world in perspective, for sure.
How you doing, Ryan?
I'm doing good, man. Skype is not cooperating. I don't know why it's being so stubborn.
You're nice and clear, though.
Well, thank you.
You want to?
I took a lot of voice lessons as a child.
Well, your connection is nice and clear, is what I mean.
You
want to tell people a little bit about where you are?
Sure. I'm currently in Arizona, in Phoenix area. I'm at the 2015 International UFO Congress. We're about 4 days in now. We've got one more tomorrow, and I head back to New York City. But it's been amazing. Huge convention. You know, we've got over 25 speakers of all types, abductees, experiencers, researchers, scientists. We even had Bob Lazar here today from, you know, the famed whistleblower of Area 51.
Right.
Who did a question and answer with George Knapp, the award-winning reporter, which was absolutely amazing. Lazar hasn't spoken about Area 51 in publicly in over 25 years, and I was one of the lucky ones to hear it live, so I feel very fortunate for that. So very exciting.
All right. And I saw you posted a picture about that.
Yeah, I've been posting like crazy as of late, just trying to let everyone know what's going on here, those who couldn't make it. But yeah, it's been very exciting. We had a Zuni Pueblo Indian here, Clifford Mahudi, who talked about the Zuni Pueblo tribe and their connection to the star people, which was absolutely fascinating. What else? We had Charlie Foltz from the Allagash abduction case. Very nice gentleman, very heartfelt story. Had a lot of evidence to back it up too, so very awesome. And yeah, it's just been a whirlwind, my friend.
All right, for some reason
I'm exhausted.
I bet. Hello, Ryan. Hello, Peter.
Hey,
Soraya.
Hi, Soraya.
Yay.
We did it.
You're both on at the same time.
Yay.
We did it.
Oh, okay. So, one of the things I wanted to touch on, and it's perfect with you being where you are right now, Ryan, is kind of the state of the UFO field in general. Mm-hmm. What are your feelings about it, especially being at the UFO Congress?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I mentioned earlier some of the people that we have here, but the thing I've noticed most this year, Soraya, is the amount of younger people. It's absolutely incredible how much it's changed from 1 year to the next. I mean, there was an influx, but it looked like a Comic-Con here, and I'm not talking about people dressed up.
Great to hear. Yeah.
It was absolutely fascinating. I mean, you know, granted, we had Bob Lazar here. That could have been why. We had some younger speakers and whatnot, but it was so exciting, you know, just seeing them come in droves and just, you know, looking up to the to some of these researchers. Yeah. So I would say this: the state of ufology, it's in a healthy place, but I think there are still a lot of things that need to be done. A lot of misconceptions, a lot of people now using the internet and not quoting their sources, not knowing where they're looking and not knowing where their information is coming from. We're bombarded by it constantly. If I could say anything, it would be that we need to really focus on our research, the credibility of our witnesses, and really get down to those nitty-gritty questions. Not get lost in the sensationalism of it all, and get the facts, get the evidence. I mean, that's what we need.
And Peter, what do you think?
Well, this is something that we've talked about, and I've certainly talked with Brian about, who is 30, as I recall. And for me, a real concern for the future is, where are the 20 and 30 somethings, you know, to kind of fill in the ranks as the senior ufologists move forward in time? This is a wonderful thing to hear. And I'm curious right now, because I'm assuming that you've heard maybe not all, but most of the presentation so far this weekend, Ryan. I'm curious to know about a few of them. I'm sure, you know, certain ones are always going to be first rate. Richard Dolan, for example, spoke about UFOs and the real power struggle and the end game, which is kind of an extension of his brilliant futuristic thinking. Did you get to hear Rich's talk?
I did. I spoke with Richard at length right before his talk. I think I told you, Peter, maybe not you, Sarai. I'm currently just finished my first draft of my book for Richard.
Yes. It's
in a very good spot, and he's really excited about that. That aside, absolutely amazing talk. And let me tell you this, Peter, only about 2% of his talk was about UFOs. Which is not a bad thing, let me tell you. Like you said earlier, the power struggle, the class system that we sort of hold ourselves at as a society, and how this may affect us maybe moving into the future, and what that might say about the phenomenon itself. But yes, I did see absolutely every presentation so far. Working backstage, I've been, you know, putting the mics on everyone and making sure they sound pretty. But yeah, I'd be happy to answer anything about any of the speakers.
James Clarkson, Finding June Crane.
Very fascinating case.
Yeah, quite a story.
Yeah, about all her work with Wright Patterson. And that's another thing. A lot of female-centric speakers this year. And subject matter, you know, we're, the three of us, we're so used to this being a boys' club. And that is another big evolution in the field of ufology. We've got some amazing female researchers rising to the ranks, and I think that's very important.
Indeed. You got to hear Charlie Fulce and Jim Wiener speak?
I did. We had Charlie here, and the other members gave us some pre-recorded Skype messages, but Charlie is just a grade A gentleman all the way through and through.
Brilliant presenter, an awful sweet guy.
Yes, there is not a doubt in my mind that this happened. If I had any doubt before, it is completely gone.
Can you tell people a little bit about it?
Yeah, I wish we could hear of two gentlemen who were part of what was called the Allagash Boys. These are four friends. Two of them were brothers, Jim Wiener and his brother. And three of them went on to become professional artists, interestingly, who were written about extensively by Raymond Fowler, one of our finest UFO writers, who now is retired, lives in New England. But the four of them what we now know based on their individual memories and physical proofs, individual regressive hypnoses, et cetera, is that the four of them were taken, were abducted while camping out in rural Maine together. In fact, they were literally taken from their canoes and then returned. And it is one of the most sensationalistic sounding stories until you see the evidence. You realize that, as in most cases of the best cases, there's really no gain here to, you know, play with the truth. I think none of these people would have liked these things to have happened to them, but their presentation is so human and so down to earth. And again, because we're dealing with professional artists, they were able to illustrate it in a manner that is so personal and so affecting that it's really hard to compare to other presentations. I just find it one of the most important cases, certainly one that's, again, belief almost doesn't enter into it. If you study the evidence, it stands on its own very strongly. Audience reactions, and what were your thoughts on the presentation, Ryan? I know you were aware of it, but I don't know if you knew some of the particulars that Charlie and Jim via Skype laid down.
Right. I knew of the case, Peter. It wasn't one that I ever researched heavily. But that being said, the evidence, like you mentioned, was there. It's there. I don't know what else people need. These men, the way that their lives changed after this event is just astounding and unprecedented. Like you said, the artists that they became afterwards begs the question of whatever happened to them. What did it open up in these men, and why? Absolutely incredible. The crowd loved it. Charlie, you know, he couldn't get out of the conference hall afterwards. Just droves of people coming up to him. And like I said before, younger people. Yeah. Just incredible.
That is so good to hear. You heard Thomas Reed's presentation.
I did. Again, very, very intriguing. What I'm finding with a lot of these experiencers, Peter, is just how gracious they are to be given this platform to tell their story. And we wouldn't be having them here at the conference speaking in front of, you know, 2,000-3,000 people if they did not have evidence to support it. And that's something I strongly respect Open Minds production, who put on the conference. That's why I respect them. They get people who they know can back up their claims. Thomas, just again, another case of mass abduction, you know, more than one person at once. That was a big theme this year.
Yeah, and in the case of Thomas's presentation, we're talking about a family history, also going back almost half a century, with some very dark aspects to the case in terms of foul play and officialdom, also brilliantly well documented. I'm not sure if he's spoken yet, but taking it in another direction, somebody who I just think the world of, Clifford Mahudi, who is a Zuni Pueblo Indian elder,
yes,
who talks in very grounded terms about the Indian people and the UFO connection in a way that is not hocus-pocusy, but really I found very compelling, and also a remarkably sweet guy, a very, very powerful presence.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I had lunch with him yesterday.
Oh, good.
I did. I couldn't pass it up. Yes, like you said, again, through and through, just a true gentleman, and he knows what he's doing, and he knows why he's here, and he's representing... He's representing a society that we often forget about when it comes to this topic, the most ancient and the most, you know, down-to-earth people we can think of are the Native Americans, and just absolutely incredible.
do me a favor. If you run into him tomorrow, take some personal business on everybody else's time. for whatever reason, in the wonderful world of technology, my emails to him have been bouncing back to me. So please send him my love and best wishes and tell him I'm working, trying to work out a way to have a friend.
Yeah.
Forward them to him to see if we can get him. Sure. Joan Bird did a talk on Montana sightings and beyond. Did you get to hear that one?
I did. I was in and out for that one, but what I did hear, again, just absolutely fascinating.
Because she's a zoologist, and that fascinated me.
She took a very, very interesting stance on it. Sort of, how would I say this? Connecting it to the very human side of the phenomenon. Again, you know, how are we connected to the phenomenon and what that might mean about what it is and who we are. Such a very articulate woman. I wish I was being articulate right now.
You're doing great.
I'm trying. I'm going on about 10 cups of coffee.
Yes, that is the fuel for an event like this.
Oh, yeah.
A couple of more questions about specific presentations. Chris O'Brien on the cattle mutilation mystery.
Yes. That one was right after I ate lunch, so that wasn't not the best idea.
Good.
I can tell you right now, I'm definitely going to be a vegetarian.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a powerful talk then.
No, just absolutely... Just great. Absolutely great. It wasn't even so much about the UFO aspect of the phenomenon, but how cattle have changed throughout history.
Yeah.
And what we have done as humans to these cattle and moving forward, what that might mean and why this is happening and why it is happening on such a grand scale. And some of the evidence, some of the pictures he showed, these incisions that have been done during these mutilations.
Oh, yeah.
He's interviewed over 20 surgeons who say that is absolutely impossible to do without some sort of laser or the finest hand in surgery. So it really begs the question as to why and how is this happening?
Yeah. And that's also what his rather epic book does, too, is go right from the very origins of us domesticating cattle up to the present day.
Yes, yes.
Which is also why it's like 600 pages long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a monster.
Really interesting.
I'm actually waiting for a copy right now.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to kind of end this round, and of course we can't get to all the speakers, but one of the biggest draws, maybe the biggest draw of this conference, is an individual who really has earned the title of legend over the past few decades. And that is Mr. Robert Lazar. Bob first burst onto the scene, I believe, in the late 80s as an individual with a credible background, according to many, in the physical sciences, certainly what he needed to have worked in classified work at the time, who alleged that he had worked out at S4, at Area 51, and gave certain schematics, was in a way the flavor of the month, so to say, was reviled, attacked, made fun of, and basically disappeared at a certain point. But for many of us, everything that could be brought forward to discredit him was countered by authentic aspects of who he actually was and the fact that he might well have been what he purported to be.
Mm-hmm.
Some months ago, he was interviewed on television, and it was really a breath of fresh air to see him as a real adult and not, you know, sort of a skinny late 20-something, early 30-something.
Right.
And he was interviewed rather than gave a talk by George Knapp, who, for my money, is the most rock-solid, real investigative reporter that we have in this field. George, of course, is an award-winning Nevada-based journalist, but I'll bet you could hear a pin drop during that interview, and I wondered if you could share some of your impressions about it, Ryan.
Yeah. today was definitely the day of Bob Lazar. I can tell you that much. We had record-breaking numbers for today. I mean, unbelievable. You couldn't move in the conference hall. Standing room, people just dripping out the doors. That being said, we had a young gentleman named Jeremy Corbell, who's a filmmaker, who interviewed Bob in a film of his. So Jeremy spoke first this morning, followed by George Knapp, who gave a incredible talk about Lazar. And then we had him. We had Bob. And I will tell you this. We were very nervous leading up to this event when we announced that Bob was going to be here. There were some speculation of if he would show up or not. Like you said, Peter, other than that broadcast that he did a few months ago with George Knapp, he has not publicly spoken about this in over 25 years.
Exactly.
But he did it. He got up there. He did an hour and a half Q&A with George Knapp, and it was incredible. He was happy to be here. He was happy to talk about it, and he got specific. It wasn't about his credentials. It wasn't about where he went to school. It was about what he saw, and he's the first to say there was absolutely no reason that I would ever make this up. He got so specific into the technicality of what he saw and the craft he worked on and who he worked with and the clearance he had to get to do it. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. and like you said, you could hear a pin drop in that place. I still got chills. You know, I had to put a mic on this guy, and here I am trying to put a mic pack in the back of his pocket without touching his butt, you know?
Excellent. And a little bit about the associated event, because every year the UFO Congress has its own film festival.
Yes.
And some thoughts, impressions on that.
I don't know if you knew this, Peter. I co-run the film festival. I've been doing it for the past 3 years with a wonderful lady named JK, who has been running the festival for I don't even know how long. She's been doing it back when it was still in Lachlan. But we had some amazing films this year. The quality and the production and the content were astounding. And we just, I can tell you some breaking news. We just had the EBE Film Festival Awards.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, along with your many credentials that you hold, Peter, I can now tell you that you are now an award-winning producer. The film that you produced, Travis, on the Travis Walton case, swept the EBE Awards. It won Best Film.
Wow.
It won the People's Choice Award. So
nice.
Yes, I got to pull Jennifer Stein aside for a little bit and talk to her, and she could not be more happy. And congratulations, brother.
Thank you. What an amazing,
amazing film. I don't know how much time went into that, but it was well worth it.
That is, of course, the best news I could hear. And Jennifer really spearheaded it. For me, I was associate producer, but that woman put her heart and soul into it. And we had Travis to work with in every possible way straight through. But for me, what's most important about it is it's not just a really great feature-length UFO documentary that, and I think now I can say it without feeling awkward because I'm not an objective player here, that holds your attention from the moment that it starts until it ends, that it's a great documentary, which is more important, and that it has a chance to really make its way out into the world of people who wouldn't look at a UFO documentary if you paid them normally. That's wonderful to hear. Wow,
very good
you made
point,
my night.
Good, I'm glad. I mean, this, like you said, Peter, I mean, we've got Fire in the Sky, but we all know the story behind that, how hyperinflated that was. Travis finally got to tell his story in a feature-length documentary, and that's never really been done. So kudos to you, my friend. We had a short film win about the Maury Island case, which was very interesting.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
And what else? We had Roger Lear won our Lifetime Achievement Awards.
Oh,
Very touching. Like, yeah, Yvonne Smith accepted the award for him, and good. there was not a dry eye in the banquet hall.
He was a great guy, and one thing you'll get a kick out of, because of course I had mentioned before to Soraya that one of our common loves and passions is live theater.
Yes.
And we both done our time in it and continue to. And years ago, it must have been about 15, 20 years ago, Roger came to New York and gave a talk for the Intruders Foundation. And it was when I was managing, I don't remember, but it was an off-Broadway play that starred Geraldine Page. And I got him and Bud, who used to come to every play that I managed, the two of them came and then backstage after the show and partied with the cast after. And Roger was just on fire, center of attention, women all over the place, absolutely regaling them with stories, and they him. It's just one of those wonderful, wonderful nights. How wonderful that he received the award this year. That's great. That's just great.
It couldn't have gone to a better person. Wow.
So what's next on your plate? I mean, tonight you head back downstairs and hang
out.
I'm
gonna head back down, you know, unwind a little bit. We'll leave it at the PG-13 version.
That sounds good.
Yeah, and then tomorrow we've got a panel discussion on whistleblowers. We're gonna have George Knapp. Who else is on that? Oh, an interesting gentleman named Mark Pinkington, I believe is his name. He's a gentleman who wrote Mirage Men and made a film about of the creating mythology. And Peter, you'll know about this, the act of deliberate deception, if not disinformation. Very interesting. He his talk didn't go over so well with our, you know, mostly believer crowd, but again, we need a healthy debate, and we need to keep this thing balanced. So I'm glad they invited him here.
I am sorry that Larry Warren couldn't be there for this one. He would be ideal for the panel.
Oh, he would have been perfect, yes. Oof. I imagine some fist fights breaking out on that one.
Yeah, well, that would have been warranted for sure. Listen, my friend, we really appreciate the time that you've given us tonight. And
Oh, my gosh, my absolute pleasure.
You know, please, any of my friends that you run into or that you know are friends, please send them my love and best wishes. If you see Jennifer, tell her that you told me and that I couldn't be happier. And, wow, and Evie, which, by the way, folks, and Evie...
Two of them.
Weighs about 15 pounds. It is the same size and scale as an Oscar. It is a gold gray alien holding a movie camera on a beautiful base, and they're hysterical. and you could easily a murder weapon in a good drama for sure.
Oh yeah. Clue style, yep.
That's great. Wonderful.
All right, gentlemen.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you,
okay,
so much.
Ryan. Big hug to you. Thanks a lot. And
yes,
have a
thank
great
you,
night.
Ryan.
Thank you, Soraya. Have a great night, guys. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.
All right, so that also kind of brings me up to one of the other questions I wanted to throw to you, Peter.
Yeah.
And initially, when we set this up, I was trying to get Mr. Paul Kimball on to discuss this because he and Greg Bishop and even Micah Hanks have kind of called for this, like, throwing the whole UFO thing out of the water and starting from scratch again. And they do make some good points, but I don't know that throwing the baby out with the bathwater is necessarily the right way to go. And I had really wanted him to come on and actually debate this with you, but he turned us down.
What a shame. You could have asked Micah, who's a good friend, let's face it, there's a lot about the field that could use some regrooving and replumbing and reevaluating, no question about it. In fact, two friends of mine had a radio show that ran for a while slightly tongue-in-cheek, but not fully, called Ufology Must Die, which I found very entertaining. And, yeah, that is a shame that Paul is not interested in discussing or debating that. But, yes, you do bring up a very important question. I think, you know, Ryan's essentially report from the field tonight shows at its best that ufology is alive and well in certain respects.
Right.
Contributions are continuing to be made by people worthy of our respect and admiration. But, boy, you know, we could devote easily several shows to this, but my first thought is the advent of the Internet is such a double-edged sword, and it's certainly not just to do with our subject at hand here. With the push of a button, you know, you type something in and you hit send, and in a moment or more, you get information on the most arcane, bizarre, reclusive, most controversial subject imaginable. And sometimes it's of real value. Other times it's, you know, stuffed full of cotton wool with little button eyes sewn on it. And it's pure crap. I think in this age of decreasing attention spans, of people who read less and less and get their information more from visual or audio sources, who wouldn't know the first thing about how to even confirm a simple fact, or maybe just that, but to do real research, original research on a subject, would not even know how to begin. The field of serious UFO studies has suffered a lot of shots, and also the gargantuan personality conflicts, the soap operas, the dramas, the infighting, add a note of, it almost gets tiresome after a while, and I know a lot of good people who have walked away from it or are considering doing just that because they see it more and more as an ego-driven personality issue where pet theories or agendas are put forward as proof or evidence, and the person putting it forward often is from the school of, if I say it louder and more often and more impassioned, people are going to start to believe it, which is unfortunately something that we know works in this crazy world that we live in, and it's not a new technique at all. In fact, it's anything but.
Right.
So that for starters, your thoughts?
Well, I think there is a certain dogma that goes along with the UFO phenomena. There's certain, especially within some of the older researchers, a certain belief system that is there. And I mean, Whitley Strieber seemed to feel the brunt of it when he suggested that maybe things weren't like they seemed, and he got viciously attacked from a lot of the ufologists out there.
Mm. Yeah, I think, you know, again, the idea of what is going on or not going on, and what is going in my on in my mind about what I want to go on, or what I think is going on, or what I believe is going on. And damn it, I'm so convinced that my beliefs are accurate, I'm going to superimpose them on what I'll laughingly call the truth and make it my business to assert myself, to bring people to my way of thinking. Mm. The old school, so to say, is more, breaks down into the nuts and bolts folks and the people who tend to follow the writings of people like Dr. Jacques Vallée. Vallée puts forward that, well, to sort of set the tone, how I'm paraphrasing a wonderful quote of his, but if he were to have learned that all of this is about beings of, you know, advanced intelligence coming and visiting us in machines of advanced technology, and that's all there was to it, he's going to be very, very disappointed. and that, you know, there is so much more going on, maybe more than we can imagine, as opposed to the folks who are convinced that it's, you know, extraterrestrials, aliens, a word I've never been comfortable using at all in this area of research, who come and go with impunity from parts unknown out there in the solar system or universe. And I maintain, after well over 30 years of study and involvement in this field, that there's probably all the stuff going on. I think it's gotten kind of trendy now to reject the, you know, hard metal machines and beings of advanced intelligence from other star systems or galaxies or what have you. I can't even say that I believe. I think mathematically it's very probable that some, and I stress some, of these anomalous UFOs, ones that are not ours, represent that. Where others are interdimensional or who the heck knows what. And again, the fighting between old school, new school, as opposed to, for me, more an idea of inclusion, that we're not alone. And that in itself is paradigm-shifting, life-changing, fascinating, and remarkable. What the specifics are beyond that, we'll probably never know in our lifetime. And anybody that says that they do know, I tend to take with a grain of salt.
That's true.
Who am I to say that they don't? But...
And that's kind of my feeling on it. My feeling is that there's definitely something going on. There's too much evidence to support the idea that something is happening. People are having these experiences. People are seeing things that we can't explain. But that doesn't mean I can in any way say exactly what that is. I mean, there's a lot of theories. Some of them hold more water than others, but none of them seem to explain it 100%.
Yeah, I believe you've really said it there. And I would love to do a show with Micah, with Paul, if he'd be willing, with anybody. Greg Bishop's an old friend, and, you know, we bantered this around quite a bit. So, to, you know, I think it's a shame when people don't want to debate these matters. That's how we grow.
Yes, absolutely.
It's another thing that I have a problem with, that there are fewer and fewer people in the field who really welcome that spirit. And I'm not talking about arguing or, you know, yelling at another person. I'm talking about debating. I think one of our great masters in that, for me as a model, is Stanton Friedman, who I used to joke with him about when our friendship was strong enough that I could, you know, imagining him as this, you know, rather intense, nerdy kid in high school who, you know, was on top of the debating team. And he said, he definitely was. To be able to argue your points in a respectful and engaging manner that's informed, that's lively, that you learn from, that the people listening learn from, should be part of what it's all about.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And to what degree do you think that, like, hoaxes and disinformation have kind of poisoned the field?
Well, I think hoaxes, per se, are a relatively small portion. Certainly, the famous ones get known. Certain aspects of the Maury Island case, one of our earliest UFO accounts going back to the first weeks of the so-called modern age of UFO sightings in the summer of 1947, as aspects of it. When you look at the history of UFO alleged photographs of UFOs,
right,
you have truly extraordinarily bluntly authentic ones, that I say that with the understanding that they go through the equivalent of often hundreds of hours of classic photo analysis by respected physicists, optical physicists, and practitioners. I put in that category in the golden years, so to say, the Trinity Island photos taken in 57 or 58 during the International Geophysical Year of these disc craft, photographed from a Brazilian naval vessel with, I think it was a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer, several hundred Brazilian sailors who were observers and who all testified to the fact that a disc of appreciable size went over the ship at a time, you know, we still don't have disc-shaped craft that we know of.
Right.
And I would question whether or not we do. We back engineering and all, and again, this Bob Lazar case being a case in point, but also the Trent family photographs taken at McMinnville, Oregon in May of 1950. Same thing in a way, except a different kind of provenance. The husband and wife, probably high school educated farmers, she called in as a disc shape was going over their farm in a beautiful part of Oregon. He came out with a Kodak camera, and I think they got two or three photos, which then went through every kind of photo analysis imaginable. They were not copywritten by the Trent family. They ended up in probably hundreds of UFO-related publications over the decades, Life magazine. They never asked for or made a cent on it. These are very important things in terms of character. I visited McMinnville a number of times. There are people who I spoke to are old enough to have remembered Mr. and Mrs. Trent, only spoke of them with great respect. Family still lives there, are well thought of. Those are examples of really quality UFO photographs. Even in the analog days, we were seeing some really wonderful fake pictures that you looked at it and you thought, gee, I hope that's true. Wouldn't it be great if it is true?
Right.
It sort of looks too good to be true. And for me, the king of that is Billy Meier. And you either are a follower of his work and think it's the most important body of UFO-related writing imaginable and the most important photographs, or you feel it's more like a cult and that these pictures are not authentic.
Right.
And I know a lot of people who I care about, who are very smart, who I consider friends, who I disagree with this on diametrically. But now, with the advent of Photoshop, you can burn people out on this crap. And, you know, somebody posts this thing, look at this amazing thing that was taken over this area, and you push the envelope a bit to try to find out where it was taken, when it was taken, who took it, and everything evaporates, and all you've got is this cool image, which means absolutely nothing. And you see, it's like the crop circle phenomena. There are people who refuse to believe that there's anything anomalous about it when there is overwhelming amounts of evidence. The reason for that has been a brilliant assault by certain people within British intelligence, the British Ministry of Defense itself, certain useful idiots in the media. Of course, most of these things, perhaps at this point the huge majority of them, are not authentic in that they're authentic crop circles, they're manufactured,
right,
but by people working on the ground as opposed to a boom and it's done. And even then, we still don't know who did it. But again, the ridicule factor that we've talked about a number of times, Soraya, that it's more important for me not to look silly being caught believing something where there's been, you know, some fakes in the field and, you know, people are going to laugh because they think, I think that's real, as opposed to, I, you know, I've studied the evidence and I know that this is a real phenomena and these things happen, even if there are fabrications. And this is a brilliant way to divide and conquer, to tire people out, to have people who really have been in the field and trying to do good work for a long time burn out, or to become figures of ridicule, or be reduced to, you know, just arguing and defending their points rather than doing the work and presenting it in a way that brings serious attention, as it should be brought, to a very serious situation.
All right. You're listening to WVBR-FM Ithaca. This is Where Did the Road Go? We're talking with Peter Robbins for a few more minutes here. And, I think the number of fake UFO videos, I just saw one the other day, someone posted warning people that these people post fakes with a little gray alien hiding under the car as these people drove down the road. And I know there are going to be people who will see that and just believe because they want to believe it.
Yes.
But I looked at it, and it just looks so fake, so bad. There's another one with the alien in the field where the guy's like, oh, it kept coming up to the house, and finally I got it on video, and it looks like a plastic toy that someone's holding up in the field for a second.
Oh, exactly. And, you know, you just reminded me last night, kind of half on a lark, I had borrowed from my brother-in-law's very extensive DVD library the first season of The X-Files. Mm. And last night, by chance, I watched the pilot. And very well constructed. Started off rather, you know, quiet. It's the one where Scully and Mulder meet. She's assigned to work with him. And the very first pan of his little basement office, the very first image that we take in is that now iconic poster. And the wording is, of course, very specifically. It's got the UFO, and it says, I want to believe. Not I believe.
Right.
Not I don't believe. And that notion, I think, has infected so much of society. Who really would like something to believe in that elevates them, makes them feel that there's an intelligence in the universe that is greater than what we laughingly call intelligence on Earth. In fact, you know, it's something that's been discussed for so long, the possibility, the fact that there are people that substitute mystical beliefs or, you know, New Age longings for the formal religions that they did or did not grow up in,
right,
which is another double-edged sword. For me, there is spirituality, there is organized religion. Find your own bliss, find your own happiness. If you can find it in one of the world's great religions, good for you. If not, you know, take the values, the best of what you can find in the theological world and the secular world, and, you know, live the best life that you can. But this desire to, you know, again, I want to believe. And so many people, they get little snippets of it. One thing that, I hope that, you know, Ryan's observation about this new influx of younger people is a healthy indication that there are, you know, a generation coming up that really does want to continue this work, this research. Maybe they just rather, you know, be entertained by the old timers, but I'm hoping that it's the former. And if so, that they, that the process continues to try to understand, disseminate the wheat from the chaff, to not be taken in by hucksters or snake oil salesmen or people who are trying to sell you their agenda or their belief as empirical fact. And, you know, a couple of my favorite of the nonsense aspects of it are people that give you a specific number. There are, you know, 83 alien races that are visiting this planet, which there is no way of knowing a number like that, or that all alien abductions are good. And the bad ones are not real alien abductions. That's the military doing it to traumatize you and give bad press to the aliens. Well, once again, establish for me how you can possibly know something like this for an empirical fact.
Right.
So, again, when somebody gives you a number or says, you know, the Pleiadians have been coming here for 843,000 years, they eat mice, glass, and dust, these are the craft that they travel in, and this is why they're here, the Nordics, the this ones, the that ones, the this ones, again, who am I to say that they're not? But I just have a big hunkin' problem.
And a lot of that stuff also comes from channeled material, I find.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, in that similar sort of realm, different at the same time, you have the work of people like Dr. Strassman and Kenneth Ring. And Ring compared the after effects of near-death experiences with the after effects of alien abductions and found them to be very similar. Or you have Strassman's work on DMT, where he showed both elements of near-death experiences and, you know, alien encounters happening during DMT sessions. And yeah. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's fascinating, and I don't jump to conclusions. I met Dr. Ring once shortly after his book came out. I think it's really important for real established scientists to have the courage to get into this work and or statisticians, so to say, and give us the benefit of their work. I think we may be dealing with entirely separate phenomena that have common functioning principles, which is not unusual in the natural world. At the same time, I don't know. I know that having had the privilege of working so closely with Bud Hopkins for so many years, and in the process of those years, getting not just to meet and hear the accounts of and spend time with, but seeing in many cases actual physical evidence associated with abduction, whether it was implants, scars that appeared on the body overnight, accounts, very believable accounts of other people, witnesses who were partial witnesses or witnesses to events that they had had, or in some cases had the privilege of spending time or meeting with the mental health professionals or physicians who also had worked with this person and backed up their claims of, you know, with extraordinarily unusual anomalous health histories or what have you. But when it became kind of chic to say, ah, there's no such thing as abduction, it's sleep paralysis combined with an overactive imagination, I thought, how insulting to these people that have been through this to dismiss it because you refuse to look any further than that, and you're very uncomfortable with the possibility that this is actually happening, but much better to dismiss it in kind than to look any further, because, yes, it is very anxiety-provoking for sure.
Sure, sure, absolutely. And I also think the work of Patrick Harper is very interesting, where he postulates sort of an in-between state between the purely mental and the physical world that kind of interchanges. And to me, that defines the UFO phenomena. It seems like there's a sort of mental, I don't want to say hallucinatory, totally real, but not quite in this physical reality sort of thing going on, as well as after effects that happen in this world.
Yes.
And the other thing I wonder, too, is if something happens in an altered state, and by altered state, I don't mean hallucination, I mean us tuning into something that we don't normally have access to. So if that happens, how much power does the brain have to create a scar on the physical body, for instance, that it believes it has from that non-physical state?
Well, that's a very important question. My first thought would go to that small but very well corroborated group of individuals that are mostly concentrated in the Philippines, as I imagine, as I remember, who at Easter time manifest the openings in their body at the signs of the cross.
Right, the stigmata, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's probably rarer. And again, for a individual, I think it's rarer than the abduction phenomena. And in those cases, the body producing, you know, a perfect scoop mark where tissue is removed, or a subcutaneous, well, again, insertion of something maybe no bigger than a grain of rice that is designed to track or what have you. Again, for anyone that is not comfortable accepting that such things happen in our increasingly technological society, and where the line between theoretics and actuality seems to get thinner, even in some of the most extraordinary aspects of technology, you can talk things away a lot better than we used to. There was a article that, I don't remember where I saw it, in the last 2 weeks about advances in very terrestrial implant technology, that it's now smaller than it's ever been, that we are going to be seeing over the next few years, I am convinced, a wholesale push to sell mostly people of means and movers and shakers in the world, but it will work its way down as things do. The idea that you can have, you know, your entire medical history, your banking history, your credit cards, all in this tiny little thing that's just inserted under your skin, and you don't have to scan a tag that's on your keychain. You can just wave your arm, you go to the hospital. You don't have to, even if you're unconscious, they've got your history right there. If you're a person with a lot of money and you have a child and you're concerned about them being kidnapped, you can now essentially lowjack your child.
Right, right.
Follow their movements and, you know, send in the troops, private or public, blah, blah, blah. Of course, you want to do it to every convicted criminal in the world. And for a lot of people, they're going to be sold on the idea this makes all the sense in the world, and it's just the way of the future. And, you know, who needs money? Who needs credit cards? Who needs little scanning things? It's all so simple if you trust the system.
Yeah. Well, there's the key, if you trust the system. And unfortunately, all systems eventually become corrupt. No matter how good the ideals are, someone's going to find a way to rig it.
Yes, and, you know, download you and strip you of all of your information or identity theft will take on a whole new dimension.
True, true. Well, we're just about out of time. Is there anything coming up you want to tell people about?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Right now, I see that the second two-thirds of my year is going to take off like a rocket here. But some of the high points, right now, working with some organizers on a speaking tour of Texas coming up probably in April. Early July, I'm going to be speaking in Memphis. I will be traveling right from there to Roswell, New Mexico, a very favorite place, and speak at the conference there, spend time with friends. Other conferences this summer as well, but starting at the end of the summer with the Experiencers Speak UFO conference in Portland, Maine, one of the most remarkable ones in that it's almost all experiencers and abductees and a few folks like me. The Exeter UFO conference and festival in Exeter, New Hampshire, one that I'm reassociated with right now. The New England UFO conference, we're working on organizing a third annual one, which will be in Leominster, Massachusetts in this coming October. Right now I'm working on one for about that same time frame for another part of Massachusetts in Great Barrington. In October, I will be in, oh my God, I'm embarrassing myself, Michigan or Minnesota at the Paradigm Symposium. I think Minnesota, bless my heart. First week in November, the Skyfire UFO Summit. This is the big one around Travis Walton's experience, and this is going to be one for the books. It will mark the 40th anniversary of the Travis Walton experience. And again, although they're not out commercially quite yet, congratulations to the wonderful team working under executive producer Jennifer Stein, who produced this remarkable, now I can say, award-winning documentary called Travis, which at some point in the next few months will be available commercially. And we're now arranging screenings of it around the country over the next few months. But wow, thank you for all the people that voted for that wonderful documentary and made my night.
And congratulations on that, Peter.
Thank you, sir.
All right. So I guess the last thing I got to tell people about next week is the Beyond the Realm Conference here in Ithaca at the Ramada Inn. That's February 28th. Lorna Reynolds is going to be running it, and most of the guests are going to be up here afterwards to talk to us. So there's a bunch of different people. Look for it on Facebook. And yeah, and I'll be part of a paranormal roundtable on that at, I believe, 5 o'clock. I'm just looking up the info right here. Along with Peter Canellis and some other people who, again, will all be up, hopefully all be up afterwards. 5 till 7 p.m. It will be a paranormal roundtable. So it's only $10 to join the roundtable and be a part of that at the Ramada Inn here in Ithaca, for those of you listening locally and interested in past lives and ghosts and things like that, because that's where it's going to focus on. All right, Peter, so we will see you again in a few months.
You bet.
And in studio, hopefully, next time if the snow melts.
Yes, definitely.
All right, we're going to take you out with some mechanism. This is Bring Back the Sun.